You know, we've got a really big night. If you look at the schedule, we've got only this evening and three more classes to go, and as we're closing in on the end of a two-year study then and all 66 books of the Bible, we've come down to that last little handful. So this is then our 95th week. We are reading pages 1375 to 1390 this week, and that covers five different epistles. Titus and 2 Timothy are the second and third in the group that we call pastoral epistles, which is really a terrible misnomer, but in the denominational world they think of preachers as pastors. And since 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus are letters addressed to men who are preachers, they've come to be called the pastoral letters or pastoral epistles, so you've got to get used to that term. And of course, they were not elders, and so we are here in Churches of Christ are quite familiar with the fact that they were not elders. That is the term then, shepherd, actually, that would refer to the elders, so we have a misnomer there. But we're also going to be looking at 1 and 2 Peter and Jude, who fall into a different category, what is referred to as the general epistles. And I'll show you a little chart on that in a little bit to come. You will have done the reading. You've seen we've got then five different transitions to look at this week. If you were here last week, you'll also recall that I was trying to come up with some sort of cutesy term, you know, for some of the real silliness that we're seeing in those transitions here in this last handful of epistles. And so rather than looking specifically at each of them this evening, well, I want to save a little bit of time anyway with so much material to cover, we'll just refer to all of them as specious scholarly sophistry. How about that one? Okay. Which again is just a fancy way of saying that these scholars are too, you know, smart for their own good. They're coming up with these ideas all the time. And it really does much of the time sound like they just need to write a new thesis for their masters, or they've got a book that they need to sell or something, and they come up with these things that are so thin and so ridiculous that it really looks like they're just looking for something, you know, they can write about, some people can talk about it. But in general, just let it be known with all five of these epistles, if they start off identifying themselves as being written by Paul, as these first two do, Titus and 2 Timothy, well, then they're written by Paul, or they're not worth reading. And the same holds then for Peter and Jude. If these men identify who they are, and then we're supposed to believe that the scholars know better and that it was somebody else, and that, you know, from the very first word of the epistles, it's a lie, well, then the rest of the epistle isn't any more trustworthy than that either. No reason for that whatsoever, and so we're not going to deal at length with those things. We did it last week anyway. Bill?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree, but I'm curious. In Nick's statement, considerable doubts have been raised about whether Paul, considerable doubts by whom?
These guys. And that's the thing, is that, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of scholars, brethren, and so you've got the full spectrum of people that are devoted to the Scriptures and serious about its study. And like they were struggling in the first century, you've also got a lot of religious leaders who are in it for the money or the power or whatever. We've seen our fair share of scandals in the United States through the years. And so you've got, you know, you've just got this whole world of academia. And so there's the answer to your question. It's all the above and everything you can think of. And it was disappointing in this particular book that at least with these last few epistles, they really did just kind of seem to jump out of the boat. Okay, but with that said, then, we've got these pages, 75 through 77, that are dealing with Titus. So we saw 1 Timothy last week, we'll see 2 Timothy in a bit. Titus is apparently written between the two. And Titus is a little bit easier to kind of peg, if you will. Paul, when he writes to Titus, is speaking of the preacher's authority and his mission. It did, in your reading, feel very different to you than when he's writing to Timothy. So we'll talk about Timothy in a minute. But Titus is a little more general and broad and authoritative than you'll find with Timothy. So as we're looking at Titus now, I thought I might just direct everybody's attention first and realize probably the print's too small here. But remember 1 Corinthians chapter 12 in verse 28, which came out about 3 weeks ago. God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, administrations, various kinds of tongues. there is a ranking in that particular passage of these different offices and or slash miraculous powers that were still being practiced there in the first century. And what's happened here is that Titus is a very young man, as is Timothy apparently, and he finds himself in this third position. He's a teacher. And he's been hanging out with Paul, he's been learning from Paul, he's been well taught by Paul, you know, and so Paul is the ultimate mentor, Paul is an apostle, but the young guy now has to stand up on his own two feet. He has to be responsible for this gigantic island, which, as you saw in the reading, has one of the longest histories on planet Earth for having people living on that island. And so he's stepping into this extremely ancient culture, you know, that's been coming down through millenniums, and he's responsible for this large area there with a number of different cities, and he's going to be on his own. He's got to take care of business there. And so Paul is preparing him for that. He's got, Titus does, reason to be nervous. I withstood numbers of people trying to get me to preach for about 5 years. I just didn't think I was ready. I didn't have the courage. I didn't think I had, you know, the fund of knowledge. And so I had people pressing on me to go to Indiana and elsewhere, and I just kept saying, you know, I just can't do it. I'm not ready. But finally, at the age of 28, I thought I was ready. So I started preaching, Smoky Point, up there in Washington, about 40 miles north of Seattle. Did I just leap into that with all the confidence of the Apostle Paul? Not hardly. So, you know, young preachers can always relate to this material. So what we're going to do here with Titus, though, is it has this nice outline, like I said. You can pick out what it is that Paul wanted this man to understand. And so see then, for instance, in Titus chapter 1, there on page 1375, in verse 5, we have this statement. For this reason, I left you in Crete. That you. And what we're going to do for the next few minutes is just go chapter by chapter, not a big book. But I just picked out each of the different categories of things where Paul is saying to Timothy, this is why I put you on that island. This is your responsibility as a preacher slash teacher. You're behind the apostles and prophets here, and so now do your job, and this is it. And so the first of these is, also in verse 5, set in order the things that are lacking. Paul, as an apostle, had a clear sense of what a fully functional local congregation looked like. He's been going from city to city trying to establish these congregations. Now he wants Titus to pick up the work, and whatever hasn't quite gotten in place yet, this is your job, Titus. Now you're going to fix what's lacking. And number two is also in verse 5 then, you are to appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. Now, we're all familiar with those qualifications. I'm not going to deal with those qualifications again tonight. Everybody in this room has been through qualifications time and time again. But the first two things that are under the category of why I put you there, Paul says, I want you to set in order what is lacking. I want you to appoint elders. Now, here's how you do it, and he gives them the qualifications for that. So that's chapter 1, and now verse 13 is still in chapter 1. In chapter 1 and verse 13, he says, this testimony is true, therefore rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith. Then he gives some explanations of things where they're not being sound in the faith. But as you can see with my note here on the screen, now look at verse 10. There are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped. Now, for those of you though that read this epistle quite a few times, you read it again this week, in verse 10, is that Titus's job or somebody else's that's being described in verse 10? Who's supposed to do the mouth stopping? That's the elder's responsibility. So he's come through, why I put you in Crete, he's given all the qualifications and explanations regarding the elders, and when he gets to verse 10, though, this is the context. This is the milieu. This is the society that he's living in. you get a lot of insubordinate people, idle talkers, they're deceivers, especially the Jews. You've got a major problem there. Now, the elders are supposed to do this thing here, and then skip down to verse 16. They profess to know God, but in works they deny Him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. And again, that's a cultural description. These Cretans had a reputation. And to this day, we have the word Cretan, you know, that is derived from it, because as Paul describes them, they've really got some serious carnality problems. So there you go. You're going to be on Crete, Titus. Now take care of business. I want you to set in order what is lacking. I want you to appoint elders. Here's what the elders are going to do. They're going to put the stop on the mouths of these false teachers and all these troublemakers that we've got right here. So make sure that the men you appoint meet these qualifications so they can do that job. All right? Then, here is, again, the same title, the reason why I left you in Crete, remember. That we're simply going to chapter 2 now. So look at chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. But as for you, so we're back to Titus specifically, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine, that the older men be. Now again tonight, you understand the moral requirements in the Bible. I'm not going to go through the moral requirements. It is Titus's job to teach older men. Then look at verse 3. It then says, the older women likewise. We still have the operative word. You are to speak the things proper that the older men be this and that the older women be that. Titus, you have to work with people that are older than you and who are the older ones in the congregation, male or female. Now, let's be careful here. I shouldn't have put that out. Read on, though, in verse 3. The older women likewise. Here's what Titus teaches them. Reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. Now you tell me in verse 4, whose job is it to teach verse 4? It's the older women's job. And it makes pretty good sense that the younger single man has authority to be teaching older men, and he has authority to be teaching older women. And then when it comes to younger women, what? You leave that to the older women. Okay, Titus, this is just smart. And so that job belongs to the women. And so you teach the older women to do these things, and part of them is to teach the younger women. Now we'll go to verse 6. And in verse 6, likewise, so Titus's job, exhort the young men to be sober-minded in all things, showing yourself to be a pattern of good works. So you are a young man, you've got to teach yourself, and you have to be an example, but you exhort the younger men as well. And then, skip down to verse 9 in this second chapter, exhort bondservants to be obedient to their own masters, to be well-pleasing in all things, not answering back. You've got another whole list. Now, bond servants in their culture is what? These are slaves. And they're slaves in the fullest sense of the term. Now, brother, nobody can know. Absolutely nobody can know. So when you read historical records and people try to make estimates, you always know it's just ballpark. But it is estimated that as much as 50% of the human beings in the entire Roman Empire were slaves. Paul's talking here to Titus and his responsibility with regard to maybe as much as 50% of the entire population of the Roman Empire. Roman's armies were just invincible. They'd taken over the then known world. And wherever they did it, they captured by the tens of thousands slaves, and they distributed them all over the empire for various jobs. You will never find that the preachers and teachers, the elders and apostles and prophets of the first century, you're never going to find any of them getting involved in politics. You're never going to find any of them teaching, you know, that we're supposed to solve all the social ills of the world. You will find them teaching how individual Christians ought to behave in the circumstances in which they find them. And so in this case, we're finding a whole lot of slaves. What are we supposed to do? Lead an insurrection? Have a giant movement? Is this Christianity's responsibility? No, it's not at all. And so, for the time being, while you're living in circumstances like that, this is how you behave. And then the last thing in chapter 2 is down at verse 15. Chapter 2, verse 15. Speak these things, exhort and rebuke with what? All authority. And then what's the next five words say? That is, to me, just the most amazing command. You know? So, James, don't you let anybody despise you. Go. Show us how to do that. You know, them fighting words? Apparently it goes back to that fine example and his teaching himself in the manner in which he behaves. But the first part of verse 15 says he is to speak, he is to exhort, and he is to rebuke, as you said, with all authority. He's got the authority of the third in the list from 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 28. So he's got a tall order here. As a young man, this is one of the first things I came up against when I started preaching, that older men find this pretty tough. They have a younger guy, you know, trying to instruct and teach them. Very difficult for older men to accept any kind of instruction from a younger guy. But Titus has authority and responsibility, and he's going to have to live up to it. So he's got really a tall order. I feel for the guy, you know, I've been there myself. Now, for this reason I left you in Crete, I'm going to go to chapter 3 now. Look at chapter 3 and verse 9. But avoid foolish disputes, genealogies, contentions, strivings about the law. Just avoid foolishness. It would be easy for Titus to get caught up in that stuff. It was a problem then. It's a problem now. It's been a problem every time in between for every congregation that there is. There's always going to be unnecessary kind of strife and wranglings that you're tempted to get involved in, and Titus needs to learn how to avoid that. Now look at 10 and 11, though, in that same chapter. The next thing he says is, reject a divisive man after the first and second admonition, knowing that such a person is warped and sinning, being self-condemned. Now he's just told him, with all authority. Now, you bump into this particular kind of a guy, he gets one warning, that's one, and he gets a second warning, and that's all, and then you just reject the guy. Now, apparently, this would lead us then into 1 Corinthians chapter 5, other passages that have to do with discipline. You got Romans chapter 15, there's other still places you can go, but it's Titus's job to see that he rejects that man. We're not going to have this kind of division going on. Okay, so there's Titus. Any comment or question? All right, great. So we pass on to 2 Timothy, pages 1377 through 1380. And as I pointed out already, look at verses 3 through 7, bottom, very bottom right there, last paragraph on 1377. This is a really personal letter. I thank God, Paul says, whom I serve with a pure conscience, as my forefathers did, as without ceasing I remember you in my prayers, night and day, greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy when I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also. Therefore I remind you to stir up the gift of God which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. Now, as you read through it this week, you would have seen that stark contrast between Titus and 2 Timothy. Timothy's a lot closer to Paul than Titus is. Timothy's letter is going to deal with the personality and the characteristics of Timothy, where Titus doesn't hardly touch on that at all. Titus had authority to go get a job done. Here's the list of things you better take care of, Titus. Then we come to Timothy, and we're talking about tears and how much I want to see you, and I knew your mom and your grandma, you know, and it's just, it's very, very much more personal. So, in chapter 1, in only highlights, we've got there three verses, but in chapter 1, let's start at verse 8, so on the top of page 1378 there. Do not be ashamed of the testimony of our Lord, nor of me his prisoner, but share with me in the sufferings for the gospel according to the power of God. Now skip down to verse 12. For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed and am persuaded he's able to keep what I've committed to him until that day. And then verse 16. The Lord grant mercy to the household of Onesiphorus, for he often refreshed me and was not what? So what's the idea you get, three different verses, when you're looking at 2 Timothy in chapter 1? Timothy's got a problem with what? He might be ashamed. He might be embarrassed. He might be weakened. He might fall prey to this temptation. And if he does, he might be hanging back in the work. So it's very personal. Paul really loves him. He's working with him. But he's sure enough saying, don't you be ashamed. Don't you be ashamed of me. I'm not ashamed. Neither was Onesiphorus ashamed. Don't be ashamed. Okay? So apparently Timothy's got some weaknesses along there. And in between all these verses, he's pumping him up. He's strengthening him. Now 2 Timothy chapter 2. Again, we're going to look at just a handful of verses, but start with 2:1, very bottom of 13:78 on the left. You therefore, my what? He apparently converted him. They traveled together. He thinks of him as a son. Be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. Skip to verse 3, top right. You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Go down to verse 5 there a few lines later. And also, if anyone competes in athletics, he's not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. The hardworking farmer must be first partake of the crops. Skip down to verse 10. Therefore, I endure all things for the sake of the elect, that they also may obtain the salvation which is in Christ Jesus with eternal glory. Now you put all those examples together. In verse 1 is the command, be strong, endure hardship. And then we've got these examples. We've got the soldier, we've got the hardworking farmer, we got Paul's own example there in verse 10. So like chapter 1, really chapter 2 is pretty easy to understand. What's the theme? Timothy, be strong. So when somebody keeps saying to you, be strong, be strong, be strong, what do you know? There's a problem with weakness. They could be given up. And so he's giving him illustrations, but it's all about Paul, with this immense personal love, saying to this young preacher, you really do need, you know, to be propped up a little bit here. You've got to, you know, not have such wobbly legs. We need to get you working. Now, in verse 22, though, he does change, you know, the theme a little bit there, where he says, left column of the next page, 1379 there in the middle of that first full paragraph, flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. So, Timothy, there are certain lusts that young men have to contend with. Flee from those things. Here's the goals. These are the things that you do want to be pursuing. Run for your life from this other. So, once again, like with Titus, you know, put the two together. You leave the young women alone. Let the older women take care of that. You flee those youthful lusts. Dig in. You got work to do there. And then we will look at 23 through 26 now. Just keep reading. But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing they generate strife. A servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, humility, correcting those who are in opposition. What's the preacher's work? Correcting people that are in opposition to the truth. Timothy, you're going to have to straighten your backbone and stand up. No shame. Be strong. Flee the youthful lusts. You're not going to be in foolish controversy, but at the same time, you've got work that needs to be done. Now comes chapter 3. And chapter 3, again, is really, you know, pretty straightforward. So I'm just calling that beware evil men. And we're just going to look at the very start of chapter 3. Know this, that in the last days, what days is Timothy living in? He's living in the last days. In the last days, perilous times will come. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, etc., 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 etc. He's not saying, Timothy, I just need you to know this. 2,000 years from now, it's going to happen. Timothy, this is what you're facing. Now, stand up like a man, meet that stuff head on. And then comes chapter 4. With chapter 4, we're just going to read those first 5 verses. Chapter 4, very bottom of right-hand column on 1379. I charge you, therefore, before God and the Lord Jesus Christ, who will judge the living and the dead at his appearing in his kingdom. Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they'll turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. But you, be watchful in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. Now he started off saying, Timothy, I'm an apostle, I laid hands on you. First I converted you, I know your mom, I know your grandma. But you've got a gift, a spiritual gift, and you need to get up and take care of that business. You're an evangelist. You've got a ministry that needs to be taken care of, and it's going to require that you get up and face a lot of opposition. Now, get yourself busy in that regard. Now, the rest of the chapter is really just him saying, follow my example. So, again, we're just picking highlights, looking at each one of these chapters, but you take Titus and 2 Timothy, in which, when you get done, what is Paul telling these young men? You get up and you do the work. And it is not going to be easy. You got natural problems with older people, or you'd be less likely you want to listen to a younger man. Don't you let them despise your youth. You preach with all authority. You're going to have false teachers. You're going to have, you know, terrible people and all kinds of problems. Tough. That's your job. Now get you busy. Check it out. Okay, you're on your own now. Bill, you're coming.
Was this the time when Paul was in prison and there was rising persecution against the church?
Yeah, I have no doubt that, contrary to the scholars and all of that, that this, of course, we know, is the last recorded epistle that Paul ever wrote, 2 Timothy. And at this time, he's told Titus, and this is going to be very similar times, two epistles written close together, you know, there's a lot going on, and there is a rising tide of persecution. Now, if we're right in guessing, as best we can figure it out, and it's pretty close, usually in a year or two, that we're looking at epistles that are written in the first half of the 60s to maybe in the middle third of the 60s. Okay? We're in that vicinity right there. Who's the emperor in Rome since 54? It's Nero. Nero is the first emperor to persecute Christians. He puts quite a few to death. The terrible fire that took place in Rome, he blamed on the Christians. He used them as the scapegoat. So, we for the first time have a Roman emperor that is persecuting Christians. Yes?
The first address to Titus, he does refer to Titus as a true son. So Titus and Timothy were like his own children to Paul. Yet he was locked up. He couldn't be there to give them his strength and to stand up with them. And he was, in his own way, he was fighting for their faith and for the faith of the church.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly it.
But the best he could do was to write.
Paul's not going to survive. He is going to lose his life now in 67 or 68, depending on who you talk to. But he got out after the first imprisonment, where he spent 2 years at the end of Acts. He got out, apparently in 63. He was able to travel for a few more years. Come 67, he's been rearrested. He stays in Nero, and this time he's cooked. He's not coming out of it alive. So he's leaving these men behind, and he knows it. And as a matter of fact, he did the reading this week, you know that Peter also knows that his time has come. Both Paul and Peter, in adjoining epistles, the way they were put together in this week's reading, both Paul and Peter say, I'm going to die. I am preparing you for my demise. And so they've done their job. They've done their job for 30 years. Now they're handing it off to the next generation. Okay, so then, that being the case, here, for instance, and I just found this online from the West Fayetteville Church of Christ in Fayetteville, Tennessee, but it's a nice little chart about what are called the general epistles. Those are James, which we've already studied 2 weeks ago, 1st and 2nd Peter, we'll look at tonight, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, epistles that we will not look at tonight, and Jude, which we will. But these are generally referred to as the general epistles. Why are they called the general epistles? Because the information that is in them is just that. It is of a rather general and far-reaching sort of a nature. It's not so personal as we had in the letters to Titus and Timothy. It has wider application to a large number of different churches, for instance. There are five of which that are going to be named. And so we are areas that are going to be named, more churches than that probably represented. And so we've come to just call these the general epistles. Now, we're not going to look at all of them tonight, but we are going to look at these two, Peter. So on pages 1380 through 1380, it's not to Peter, but from Peter, we have 1 Peter. And as you look at 1 Peter, and 2 Peter too, but particularly in 1 Peter, I've just got a whole lot of suffering going on. Okay? And everybody immediately, you read 1 Peter, and it's just complete for five chapters. This persecution that Bill's just referring to is really serious. Now, persecution is nothing new. Who started persecuting Christians? The Jews. But, you know, 8th chapter, you got Paul in the book of Acts. You know, Stephen's killed in chapter 7. He's romping and stomping, Paul is, in the first few verses of chapter 8. Persecution is nothing new. The Jews have been chasing them all over. You know, one city to the next. That's the Nike of Berea. And so, nothing new about that. What's new, though, is that as these years are going by, the emperor himself, Nero, he's now getting involved. Now they're catching it, not just from the Jews, but from the Gentiles, and not just from the religious front, but from the political front. And so the Christians are really hurting. This was not a time you'd want to live in. And so many times, you know, my fascination with Israel itself, you know, but, you know, I've thought through the years, I wish I could be there. I wish I could see it. I wish I could hear how Jesus spoke and never man so spake, you know, and falling back when he just says, I'm the guy you're looking for. And I wish I could see the bearing, the manner, and hear the words themselves, you know. But no. And I get to thinking about the times. No kind of fun for these poor Christians in that first century. They were in a crucible of suffering. They were paying the highest prices imaginable for their faith. And that's just the way it has to be as the church is born. So we're going to start, though, with the transition. I do want to spend quite a bit of time with the transition on page 1380 here. We're actually going to look at three different aspects of it. So first, let's get this battle line thing. On page 1380, in the right-hand column, first letter of Peter, transition, in the first paragraph, look down toward the end of the fourth line there, and we'll start reading, the name Babylon, in 1 Peter 5:13, she was in Babylon, then is likely a figurative description of Rome. I don't believe that for a minute. I'm going to show you why in just a second. Now skip down to the third paragraph in that transition. If Peter was not the author, it surely was, but look at then the very end of the second line there, the symbolic reference to Rome, which now in the transition they're just assuming is true, the symbolic reference to Rome as Babylon, found in several early Christian writings, see Revelation 17:5, probably resulted from Rome's destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, a tragic event that repeated the conquest by Babylon in 586 B.C. True enough, what happened in Jerusalem and the temple in 586 B.C. at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdom of Babylon at that time, 600 some odd years before this, that happened. And Rome is in fact going to do essentially the very same thing again in 66 to 70 A.D. I'm not denying any of that. What I'm denying, though, is that Rome should be understood as Babylon in this passage, and or in Revelation. So if you want to take a quick note right here, in the transition they reference Revelation 17:5. So here it is. Revelation 17:5-6 says, on her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. Now our scholars here are suggesting Rome should be called Babylon the Great. Rome should be called the mother of harlots and the mother of the abominations of the earth. Why? I really don't think so. Because the very next thing that is said is, and I saw the woman drunk with what? The blood of the saints. So who's responsible for the blood of the saints? The woman with the mystery name that is Babylon. And with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. Now, if you were paying attention when we were doing Acts, remember back in Acts six weeks ago, when we first got started in Acts, I showed you that special word, witnesses, 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 and how many times it pops up in the early going and even the later of the book of Acts. And every time, in the context, how very specifically it was defined, the witnesses in the book of Acts, how many of them are there? There's 12 of them, okay? They are the apostles. It's not just anybody and everybody. It's the apostles. This mystery Babylon is the mother of harlots and the abomination of the earth. She's drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses. She's responsible for killing these apostles. Now, the question is that Rome? Should we blame Rome? Now, just starting with Jesus, who killed Jesus? They were Roman soldiers, to be sure, but who killed Jesus? The Jews killed Jesus. Rome's just an instrument that they forced to do that. Now, I would like for everybody please to compare Romans 17 with Luke 13, verses 33-35. Jesus said in Luke 13:33, it cannot be that a prophet would perish outside of where? Jerusalem. Now, I don't know how to get around that statement, and I'm not nearly scholarly enough to figure a way. It cannot be, Jesus said, that a prophet would perish outside of what city? Jerusalem. So should I be blaming Rome? I don't think so. And then the very next thing that it says in Luke 13 is, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, you would not. Behold, your house has left you what? Desolate. Now, for those of you that have been here, we've been studying all this at some length in Matthew 24 as well. In Luke's Gospel, is chapter 13 the Olivet Discourse? No, that's chapter 21 in Luke. This theme runs throughout the Gospels. But this theme, brethren, is that Jerusalem is the city that kills the prophet. Jerusalem is the one that stones the earth. It can't be that a prophet would perish and Jerusalem not be responsible for it. Now look at this in Matthew 23, verses 34-36. Jesus said, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you'll kill and crucify. Some of them you'll scourge in your synagogues and persecute from city to city, so that upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Who's being charged with the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth? In Matthew 23. It's Jerusalem and those Pharisees that were ruling over it. And so there's absolutely no doubt, scripturally, that the Babylon we're talking about here is not the physical city off in Iran. What we're talking about is Jerusalem. And then, of course, Jesus added, truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. I don't think it's a physical city at all. I think it's Jerusalem being represented as guilty of the blood of all the saints. Okay, so with that, on first transition, back to page 1380 again, there's a second authorship statement that's in the second paragraph there. Some scholars reject Peter's authorship, the good style, which certainly wouldn't want to accuse Peter of having a good style, an extensive literary vocabulary of the author could not have come from a Galilean fisherman. No kidding. Yeah, and I think laughter is just the only thing that a statement like that ought to be met with. That's just pure silliness. Moreover, the letter shows the influence of Paul's theology and vocabulary, such as the expression in Christ. Now I've got the paperwork right here, brethren. This is where Paul put his copyright. There's a patent on the phrase in Christ. Who's it belong to? Computer, is it? Not without paying royalties. You see how utterly absurd that this is. And so I just want you to know that when the first verse says Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, how many apostles were there? 12. Who was pretty prominent among them? Peter. And if that first verse isn't true, then is there another statement in the book that you should be believing to the point that you would be persecuted like these people are unto the death? Well, hardly. Peter wrote the epistle. It's like he said he did. The apostle wrote the epistle. Now, how many of you know J.K. Rowling as well as I do? I've read every one of those Harry Potter books. I've cried at some point. I'm telling you. I own the movies. Now, we all know that a divorced single mother who doesn't have a job can't write such a book. That's impossible. We just know that, don't we? Now, somebody said no single mother could write the Harry Potter series. What's your reaction to that? Well, she did. You know, and so this kind of stuff, I think, again, is just the specious sophistry and these scholarly philosophers who just really ought to get a job at McDonald's so they could get their heads straightened out on how to think. Okay, and then the third one here, and there's quite a debate on all of this, is this first epistle written to Jews or to Gentiles? And what's the appropriate three-letter response to that? Yes. It's written to both. But I do want to emphasize this, though, brethren. And if you've got a highlighter or some kind of, you know, way to make a cloud with a pencil or whatever, I think this is important. You probably picked it up because they're italicized and usually indented. But in chapter 1, in verse 16, over in the right-hand column, the last part of that first paragraph, "Be holy, for I am holy," is from Leviticus 11, 44 and 45. That's Leviticus 11, 44 and 45. At the bottom of the page, you see all flesh is as grass. That's Isaiah chapter 40, verses 6 through 8, spilling over onto the next page. Isaiah 40, 6 through 8. Then in chapter 2, you can see that, "Behold, I lay in Zion," is Isaiah 28 and verse 16. 28, 16. Isaiah's back again in the right-hand corner of the top of the right-hand column, pardon me. "A stone of stumbling and a rock of offense," that's Isaiah 8, chapter 8, verse 14. And then when you come over to 1383 in the left-hand column, "Who committed no sin," that's Isaiah 53, verse 9. Isaiah 53, 9. The right-hand column, "He who would love life," that's Psalm 34, verses 12 through 16. Psalm 34, 12 through 16. When you come to page 1385 in the left top, you have to pick it out of the first line right there. "Love will cover a multitude of sins." They didn't indent it this time. That's Proverb chapter 10, verse 12. Proverb 10, 12. At the bottom of that column, "If the righteous one is scarcely saved," that's Proverb 11, 31. 11, 31. And then in the right-hand column, chapter 5 there, in verse 5, "God resists the proud," that's Proverb 3, verse 34. So he tries to argue, you know, well, this is all Gentile church. Well, if so, what would you think about 1:16 and 24 and 2:6 and 8 and 22 and 3 chapter 12 and 4:8 and 18 and 5:5? That's a whole lot of Old Testament for people that never had an Old Testament, never studied an Old Testament. But it is true, you see right here in chapter 2 and in verse 10. So come on back to 2:10. And I can find this myself now. So 2:10. He's over on page 1382. "Who once were not a people, but now are the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." you've seen verbiage like that before from Paul. When Paul speaks in that manner, what's he doing then? Who's he talking about? Talking about the Gentiles who are not among the chosen people of God. So the answer is not Jews or Gentiles. It's a mixed congregation, which primarily is getting information that's directed to the Jews. Now, by the way, Paul is the apostle to the what? And Peter is the apostle to the... So what would we expect Peter to be writing to? Jews. Okay? Both the first and second epistles, in my opinion. Okay? Now, again, and I'm attacking 1 Peter in a very different manner than I did these others. 1 Peter, I would like for you to see these passages that seem to indicate immediacy in what he's talking about. Not that it's thousands of years away, but it's right upon these people. We're just going to pick this out again. If you want to make your little cloud or whatever, it'll be very fast and it'll be very difficult. I'm not even giving you whole verses. It's just phrases out of these verses. But I want you to see this. In page 1381, in the left-hand column, just above verse 6's indentation, there's a salvation that's ready to be what? Revealed in the last time. But we've already found out who's living in the last time. Timothy is, and so are they then, because they're living at the same time. And then, hard to pick out, but just above verse 8, now I know it's just hard to pick out, I'm sorry, but just above the verse 8, the last phrase there is the revelation of Jesus Christ. What does that immediately make you think of? The revelation of Jesus Christ, which is the first words in the book of Revelation. This is what they're expecting. Now, I'm quite convinced the book of Revelation is talking all but 18 verses about events that take place in the first century. Then look at verse 9, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. That's the word for spirit, sometimes translated life. Of this salvation, the prophets have inquired and searched carefully who prophesied of the grace that would come to whom? To you. Now look at verse 12, you've got to pick it out about four lines down. To them it was revealed that not to themselves, but to us, they were ministering the things which now have been reported to you. It's very personal for the people that he's writing to. In the right-hand column, in verse 13, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the title of the book of Revelation. Then, skipping way down to verse 20 there in that next paragraph, he indeed was foreordained for the foundation of the world, but was manifested in these what? In these last times. He's telling you they're living in the last times. What he's talking about is in the last times, and they're in the last times. Turn the page on 1382 in chapter 2, in the right-hand column right under the title, Living Before the World, at verse 12, having your conduct honorable among the Gentiles, that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. I think that's a day of visitation where this will happen in the lifetimes of these people. Now turn the page to 1384 in the right-hand column in chapter 4, verse 5. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. And then look at verse 7, right under serving for God's glory. The end of all things is what? It's near. It's at hand. Somehow we've got to take that into account. Is near or at hand something you describe 2,000 years away? I can't. Now in 1385, the left-hand column, verse 12. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, not people 2,000 years away, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice in the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. Now look down at verse 17 in that same column. It's indented. The time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God in a couple of millenniums. That couple of millenniums idea is not in the verse. You've got to put it there, but you won't find it there. In the right-hand column on 1385, chapter 5, in the third line there toward the end, that first verse, partaker of the glory that will be revealed. There's those revelation ideas again. And in verse 4, when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. Chief shepherd's coming. They're expecting you. And then in verse 6, that he may exalt you in due time is the last of these. Now, I will freely admit that for some of these, I could go the other way and say, well, I can see how that might apply to a final judgment, which the Bible does speak of. 1 Corinthians 15, chief among them. I believe in a final judgment. I believe in the end of planet Earth. None of that has changed. But in a given context, when he writes a letter to some people, we're trying to keep it in that context. We can derive whatever message we should 2,000 years later, but it ought to mean something to the people he wrote it to, and it shouldn't be confusing and almost impossible for them to understand. So, here's what 1 Peter is all about. Follow me. That's what Peter's saying, just like Paul always did. Follow me. Now, I knew I was up against it, you know, this evening. It's for no other reason than I'm just weak because of the illness, but I will not have time then jot these down. I was going to say, here's an outline for it. I would say, look at 1 Peter 2, verses 4 and 5, and then in 1 Peter 2, verses 9 and 10, and then verse 13 and 14. I'm just going to hustle through these slides. So there would be my kind of outline for chapter 2. Chapter 3, it would be verses 13 through 17. Chapter 4 would be 12 through 16. And chapter 5 is the first four verses, which is where I think I'd like to end then. The elders who are among you I exhort, I who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that will be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the crown of glory that does not fade away. So I'll leave it to you to sort out whether the immediacy passages suggest a judgment and a revelation and a glory that they would receive in their time, or if all those ideas should be put 2,000 years into the future. I can see some of them going either way, so can you. But 1 Peter, you'll have to sort out on your own. And you're especially going to have to do that with 2 Peter. 2 Peter is one of the most difficult books in your entire Bible. All we can do in a few minutes we've got is to think about it in the most general terms. And so, as you turn the page, and I guess I forgot Jude, didn't I? Jude is easy, please everybody, 1387. Jude is just like 2 Peter. That's why we can put the two together. They're so alike that they're even, suggesting they're written by the same guy or copied the same guy and all that same kind of silliness. But in 1387, at the very top of that left column, but you, beloved, remember the words which were spoken before by the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ, how they told you there would be mockers in the last time who would walk according to their own ungodly lusts. These are sensual persons who cause division, not having the Spirit. Most of that whole epistle is about these awful, awful people. So what do you do with them? Verse 3, the bottom of 1386 on the left. Diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, necessary to write to you, exhorting you to what? Times are really hard, brethren. You contend earnestly for the faith. And that, too, is what 2 Peter is all about. Peter is telling these people, it's tough. I know it. You got to get up and do the job. So he says, we'll close here, 1388, in the left-hand column at the very bottom. Grace and peace be multiplied to you in the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. If you want any grace and any peace in your life, where are you going to get it? In the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord. As his divine power has given to us all things that pertain to life and godliness, through the knowledge of him who called us by glory and virtue, by which have been given to us exceedingly great and precious promises. Through these you may be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. These people are up against it. They're suffering badly. Just don't be tempted by any of the lusts of the flesh. You're going to fight that good fight. You're going to lean on this divine power, this godliness, this knowledge of Him, and He has called us. Now, 2 Peter and Jude are really grim reading, and they're nearly identical. They suggest it almost verbatim. And that's what that whole second chapter here is like. It's the whole of Jude as well. So you can read that for yourself. They were living in monstrously unhappy times. And then the third chapter is one of the most difficult chapters in the whole book. I got a call this week from a guy who says, please cut some time for me. You know, I want to talk to you about 2 Peter chapter 3. Well, okay, let's do it. Not tonight.